Hey, everybody. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good midday. Before we get to my guests, I'm going to be giving you a Valentine's Day gift. Me, live, February 14th to the 16th. I'm going to be at the Punchline in Philadelphia. So if you're in the area, come on out, and I'll be dressed as Cupid. Very hairy, but it'll be worth it. February 14th to the 16th. Philadelphia Punchline. You can go online to get tickets. My guest this week is one of the legends in comedy, and I'm so excited to have him on the show. And one of the highlights of my doing this show and why I do this show, the brilliant mad genius John Cleese from Monty Python is on my show, and he's awesome. The conversation goes in a million directions, which makes it awesome. And he's got a live tour, which you should go see. So check out John Cleese and check me out February 14th to the 16th at the Punchline in Philly. And I'll tell you some secrets about John Cleese. All right. Enjoy John Cleese. On the line with me is an icon to me from Monty Python.
Well, I'm at the National Institution.
I'm sorry.
I was a comedy icon, and I was promoted last Thursday. I'm an National Institution.
Okay. I'm sorry. You know, that was sent to me in some notes, and I missed that. I'm sorry. A national institution, a treasure, one of a kind. I can keep going.
Yes, but it's some kind of treasure. It's not just a treasure. It's a something treasure.
It's a
national treasure. Maybe I'm not a national institution. Maybe I'm a British institution and a national treasure.
But why are we limiting
a comedy icon?
But wait, let's go bigger. An international. How about an intergalactic treasure? How about that?
Yes, that's good. I'll buy that.
Okay.
Intergalactic. Yes.
And
I'll bring that up at Terry Jones' funeral. Give me something to crow about.
By the way, I had Terry on my podcast. He's a great guy. He was great. He was terrific. He's so special.
He was a lovely, lovely chap. And yeah. When we did the O2 show, he just mentioned to us that his memory was not what it was. And we had a little bit of fun. I remember him once sketch because he was allowed to read the contents of the wizard chocolate box, and he couldn't get the reading right, so I took the card from him and said, let me give you a bit of help with that, sir.
That's terrific.
He laughed, and the audience adored it. And then just a few weeks later, we heard it was something serious, you know, this dementia.
Oh, God.
And then he's just been quietly fading away. Yeah. I've hardly been in England the last 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him at a funeral, which is where, for my age, you see your friends most frequently. And I think he recognized me. But that was probably a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, Michael lived right up by him in Hampstead and saw him on a regular basis. And then he faded away.
Yeah, it is it's a sad thing that really saps people. I am talking to John Cleese, by the way, for those listening, who you know from A Fish Called Wanda, Fawlty Towers, Monty Python, just an intergalactic treasure, and he has a live show live on stage that he's touring with, and also screening the 45th anniversary of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and it is such an honor and a pleasure. I'm running out of other words to have you on and talk to you.
Well,
and
I'd say to your audience, Paul,
yes,
that you know they live pretty drab, undistinguished lives. As if they come and see me live on stage, you know, it's a moment that will flash before their eyes as they lie there on their deathbed. You know, it will give them a sense that their life has had some purpose. I think it's a wonderful gift that some genius like I gives them.
Exactly.
And I shall be interlocuted by my daughter, Camilla, who does a lot of these shows with me. Because we used to use local radio celebrities, and the problem was they were much too respectful. And there's no danger of that with my daughter. She's very funny. You want to go on YouTube, Camilla Cleese, you'll see her stand-up routine, and they're absolutely top class. So we'll be doing it. We'll watch the movie, and then I will explain to people what's wrong with the movie. Because, of course, it was recently voted 8th funniest film ever made, and there's lots of things wrong with it, and I like to point those out. Large, very curious sport.
By the way, I have a child. Is it difficult to work with your child and not be a dad and correct her and sort of guide her or give her the wide berth that an adult should have? Do you still treat her like your little girl, or are you, give her space?
I don't know. There's something very special there, but it doesn't tend to become very. What's the word? Intimate. I think it's all based on a common respect for insulting other people.
Yes.
I had a tom-tom thing once where my voice was heard of people driving cars, you know, in 300 yards turn left, and I gave it to her and she handed it back to me the next day, and I said, "Oh, what's the matter?" She said, "It's dangerous, Dad." And I said, "What do you mean it's dangerous?" She said, "Well, I'm so used to doing the opposite of everything you tell me." I thought it was a very good
joke. I should tell people, by the way, that I had to carry you in a scene on television years ago. And you won't remember this because you're drunk all the time. But Wednesdays at 9:30 on ABC was a short-lived sitcom that you were in, and I had a very brief scene with you where I was a security guard in a prison, and I had two lines, and you kept saying to the director, "I can't work in the presence of such a genius, me," and that it was you were unable to function because you were so intimidated by my acting prowess. But I just wanted to put that out there. That's
well,
awesome.
Isn't that funny? I don't remember that at all.
well, maybe you got a little, maybe you got a little Terry Gilliam thing going on there, huh? I actually did act in the scene with you, and it was the exact opposite. I was so thrilled.
What was the movie? What was the movie?
No, it was called Wednesdays at 9:30. It was a sitcom on ABC, and you played a Rupert Murdoch type. Remember?
It was a rather good show. I was playing Rupert Murdoch.
You were.
I loved doing that. Oh, I thought it was very funny because it was quite black. Mm. And I had a feeling it was going to be fun, but then they came up with this terrible title. And I thought it was terribly funny because the second show went out on a Tuesday, and Wednesday morning they basically cancelled the series. And I thought it was terribly funny because the whole show was about the insanity of television.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So they cancelled it before anyone's had a chance to see what it's really like. Yeah. Yeah, I don't have a very high opinion of most television executives. My starting point, which is based on 50 years' experience, is that less than 10% of them have any idea what they're doing.
Why do you think that is?
For that percent. Because they don't know that they don't know what they're doing. You see, there are very few smart people around. The smart people kind of know how smart they are. They know that they're smart in some areas, but not in others. And they can sort of take that into account when they're assessing these things. But television executives, once they've been given a desk, they think that somehow there's been some mystical process by which an understanding comedy has been vouchsafed to them by God Almighty, along with the desk. An expertise which it takes most ordinary people about 25 years to achieve. See what I mean? And they start telling you what you ought to be doing. My favorite story was the wonderful, wonderful film director, Billy Wilder, who went in to see a young executive. And he said, "Well, Mr. Wilder, could you tell them what you've been doing recently?" And Wilder said, "You first." great story.
That is wonderful. That's great. Did you work with Frank Oz? I know you did Muppet. You worked on The Muppet Show and The Great Muppet Caper. Did you work with
Frank?
Yeah. Well, Frank is a good friend of mine.
I knew Frankie very well because he was in London at one time. Henson Associates were unable to get anyone in America to give them a sort of early evening slot. They could only get a children's television slot. Mm-hmm. And one of our guys, Lord Grade, gave them an early evening slot. So we've got a lot of adults as well as some smart kids. And I got to know Frank very well. And I'm very, very fond of the man. But I haven't seen him for some years. I mean, I did one or possibly two Muppets movies. Maybe it was only one. And I did the TV show. Mm. And I very seldom actually performed with Frank. But he was a friend whom I saw and had dinner with in London. And then when they went back to America, the show, well, you know, geographically, it was, I saw him less and less. But one of the great sadnesses of my life is that he offered me a role in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. And I couldn't take it because I was... didn't really know what had happened to my marriage, and I thought I was better go back to England and sort out whether I was still married or not. And it's, I'm so sad about that, because the first half of that is a genius comedy. Second half, very good too. Mm. And Frank, I will really enjoy to work with Frank because he's just a lovely man.
He is. He's been working with me on a one-man show that I've been doing in New York, and he's been a godsend. Yeah, I'm serious. I've been doing a one-man show where I bring people on stage improvisationally and let them tell stories from their lives, just regular people in the audience. Because I've found that people have these incredible stories from doing stand-up all over the world, really. And I thought that there should be a show, because I feel like if we talk, we connect. And if we connect, maybe things aren't so divisive and we're not so divided. Because I think we have...
Yeah.
You know, so he's been working with me.
I felt that at the O2 with those 16,000 people, all in a good mood.
Yeah.
All being just friendly and having a nice time. It was a lovely experience.
Yeah.
But you said Frankie's helping you with that, or was helping you?
No, he is. He's been working with me. He lives in New York, not far from me, and I'll be seeing him, and I'll pass along your regards, and I can even
would
put
you... Would you get my address to him? Because I shall be in New York in a bit, and I would just adore to see him again. I don't know how old Frankie is. I think I'm older than he is, but I'm 18 now, so we better hurry up and have dinner.
So you're going to be telling stories from your life, and you're going to be with your daughter in this show, and there's so much I want to talk to you about.
We show Holy Grail, Paul. And then after we've shown Holy Grail, we take any questions from the audience. So it can go in any direction that the audience wants to take it. In other words, we can talk about Python, or we can talk about politics or God. Camilla's very good with electronic stuff. So she sits up next to me, and people text her questions from the audience, which is the best way of doing it, because in big theaters, you can't get the microphone to people, and getting them to write the question on cards before the beginning of the show means that they've got to ask a question without having heard the show.
Mm.
So this is a perfect solution for it. She's very good at it. She also, she knows what my good stories are, so she can, what's the word, shepherd me in that direction.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned God, and religion seems to be a recurring theme in your work over the years, and also the Roman Empire and all of that. What is it about that commentary that you feel felt compelled to make about religion? Where did that sort of focus come from, if you will?
Well, I think it came from the beginning, from Life of Brian, because when I was at university, I just decided it was all a lot of rubbish. And then when the Pipers got the idea of Life of Brian, which was about 76, I started reading books for background, and I just began to get very interested in, you know. And I think the main problem is not with religion, but it's with churches. You see, human beings, as we all know, can fuck anything up. Look at the impeachment trial. I mean,
yeah.
The founders must be turning in their graves.
Yeah.
For this particular impeachment trial. We're selling Ukraine down the river, and they're an ally against Russia. Selling them down the river, which is a short-term political advantage, it may not be right, but it's not impeachable. And you want to say, well, in that case, what is? What was the last impeachment? The last impeachment was somebody lying about a blowjob.
Exactly.
So I thought, well, if the Democrats had been smart, they'd have got Stormy Daniels in to testify while the impeachment process was still in the House. But then I think that the Trump supporters would have said, but when Trump denied knowing her and all that crap, he wasn't under oath. So this is, you see, this now in Republican political thought, this is why a president can tell lies continuously, because he's not under oath.
Right. And it's true. And it's not going to go the way it should. And it's going to be an ugly outcome. And now it looks like they're not going to allow witnesses. And I mean, it's in their voters' hands now. But all of that,
I think it's a very good principle. And I think an awful lot of murderers and felons in general would agree that not allowing witnesses at a trial is a very smart move for them.
Exactly. Why didn't I think of that? I think it's one of the, right?
Why didn't I think of that? And of course, the extraordinary thing to me is that you have these, I mean, the politest term would be loose cannon.
Yeah.
But I would say people bordering on the bordering the edges of manic behavior.
Yeah.
You have Giuliani and Dershowitz, absolutely out of control and not capable of saying a coherent sentence or one that doesn't contradict what they said just a few years ago.
Right.
And it just astounds me that this doesn't bother the Republicans. And as somebody is now saying quite rightly, what they really want is a king.
Yes.
But not a modern king, you know, a king somewhere back in the 1600s,
yeah.
Who, continental doctrine of the divine right of kings, that's, the divine right of Donald Trump. It's all right if he sells an ally against Russia down the river because he's president.
And yeah.
It's incomprehensible, but you have to take it seriously because it's actually happening. My own feeling is, most powerful person in America at the moment is Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
Because Rupert owns Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
And if he pulled the plug on Trump, Trump wouldn't last 3 weeks. The only reason he's there is Fox News, because that's where 40% of his supporters get all their information from. Mm-hmm. Not most of their information, but all their information. So I pray every night that the good Lord will convert Rupert Murdoch into a decent human being. But, I don't know. Some people say prayers are effective. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because a commentator said recently, if there were a Fox News in the day of the Nixon impeachment, there's a good possibility he would not have resigned and wouldn't have been impeached. But the power of Fox News has...
Of course he wouldn't have.
Yeah.
No, but the Republicans could never forgive the Democrats for impeaching Nixon, even when he admitted it and all that kind of thing. They still wanted revenge, so they got it against Bill Clinton. You remember they investigated the Whitewater companies to see what illegal transactions had taken place. Ken Starr was in charge of that, now defending Trump. And they never came up with anything wrong with Whitewater. And so they had to find something else. And they had to find catch Clinton in a lie about blowjobs. I don't think there's many human men on the planet who haven't lied about blowjobs.
Exactly. See, it's the other way. It's going to be tough being a lawyer for somebody testifying about that. The person's going to want to brag. Well, let me tell you then what happened. No. Stop talking. We get it. You like.
Real quick.
And then they call law, and then what did that stupid man Gershwitz, ex-Harvard or something, and suddenly says to the Elizabeth Warren, you don't understand the law, and he clearly doesn't understand it at all, since he's taking a position exact opposite of what he said some years ago.
Exactly.
Oh, it's just hopeless. I don't think there is any hope for the world, you see. But the nice thing is, at the age of 80, I'm not going to be here much longer. So younger people are going to inherit this fuck up, and good luck to them.
There you go. You should put that on your tombstone. You're going to inherit this fuck up. Good luck to you.
On my tombstone, I have the words, I've already carved them myself, the words, no more waiting for women.
Oh, my God. Can I ask you real quick about radio and the impact of radio on you as a person and a performer? I mean, I know the Goon Show was a big part of your life growing up. And then, but you wrote and performed in radio. And I was wondering, you know, I've written on The Daily Show, wrote on The Daily Show for quite a while and other shows. What kind of a impact did writing and performing for radio have on you, or on you as a performer and a writer in the visual mediums? I would imagine it, you know, made you a really strong writer and performer when you moved over to TV and film. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that is right. I used to think that the only thing I had going for me was that I had a very good sense of timing, which I think has stayed with me. And I felt there were so many other things I couldn't do. I mean, when you think of Steve Martin, who can play a musical instrument and dance and do conjuring, and you know, and the man is so multi-talented, and all I could do is write some good jokes and tell them rightly. But my ability for physical comedy developed much more once I was on television. Originally, I'd been a writer in radio and a performer, and so that was good because it had me focused on structure and words, so that was valuable. The physical comedy came very much later. I didn't really know that I had any ability in that area, and I always used to think how good Graham Chapman was in that area when I wasn't.
Well, you guys would feed off each other a lot and write together, and I believe you said that there would be times when Graham may not say much in a writing session, but then would say something that would sort of elevate the script. And I think you point to the Broken Toaster Dead Parrot sketch as one of them, where he suggested you change it to a dead parrot. Is that right?
Yes. When it was originally a secondhand car. Yes, for Rick, he was like that because he was very good. He was never totally present. You know, he never looked at Graham. He was sort of dreaming about something else or looking at his watch or filling his pipe with tobacco. He was never 100% present. I mean, I did all the donkey work. I was the one in the engine room.
Right.
But because of that, he would sometimes, when I was getting a bit stuck and perhaps trying to be a bit too logical in the sketch, then he would come up with something off the wall. And that would completely energize us in a new direction. Right. But it was a joy working with him, particularly in the first series before he started. Because you see, really, between the first and second series, he became an alcoholic. It was very rapid. It was very, very rapid. And I remember it sometime into the second series when we were all in a trailer and we wanted to check some dialogue, and Michael Palin said, I came in with Graham in the morning. He's got his script in that little suitcase. And Michael opened the suitcase and took the script out, and then he sort of went almost white. We all said, what's the matter? And he pointed at a bottle of half full vodka and said, that was fool's morning.
Oh, boy.
And this was about 10:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And that was for the very first time we realized that Gray had a serious problem. And it's one of the reasons eventually that I left the group, because no one else wanted to write with an alcoholic who often couldn't remember in the afternoon what you'd written in the morning.
Well, listen, I could talk.
Then he sobered up. And he was an extraordinarily good actor, if you think of him both as King Arthur and as Brian. They're absolutely wonderful performances.
Yeah, he really is. Listen, I could talk to you all day. It's really an honor to have you on. And for all listening.
And as I said earlier, Paul, you know, on your deathbed, you'll be able to treasure this book.
I certainly do. Intergalactic Treasure, John Cleese. Please go online. Find tickets and go see him in his live stage show with his daughter. Honor to have you on. And please don't die in the next half hour.
All right. And ask the audience, please, not to ask polite questions. The ruder, the better.
You got it. There you go. How great is he? I had about 20 things I wanted to talk to him about. We got to none of them or a couple of them, but we got to all this other great stuff. So just the guy's awesome. And I did act with him in one scene for about 2 seconds. So John Cleese, hope you enjoyed him the way I did. And February 14th to the 16th, I'm going to be at the Punchline in Philadelphia. So come on out, bring me some Valentine's Day candy or, you know, your birthday suit, whatever works for you. February 14th, 16th, Philly Punchline. You go online to get tickets, and we'll see you next week, everybody.